Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, and dedicated to the proposition articulated by Walter Lippmann during World War II that a strong and balanced foreign policy is the shield of our democratic republic. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and a Bulwark contributor. My normal partner in this enterprise, Elliot Cohen, is still traveling, but I'm joined today by Dale Copeland, professor of government at the University of Virginia, and author of a new book, A World Safe for Commerce, American Foreign Policy from the Revolution to the Rise of China. It builds off earlier work of Dale's on economic interdependence and war, as well as the origins of major war. Dale, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Great to be here, Eric.
Well, your book is an extraordinarily ambitious effort to revise sort of neo-realist international relations theory, and also to reinterpret American diplomatic history over the last 250 years plus, and as well a policy book full of recommendations for policymakers about U.S.-China relations, which you obviously see along with the national security strategy and others as the major challenge facing the United States looking forward into the future. So, Dale, could you explain your core argument, and in particular how you see yourself revising realist theory?
Sure, Eric. Great question. I'll try to. I tend to be long-winded, so I'll try to keep it to 5 minutes. One of the most straightforward distinctions in our field is between, this is international relations, is between so-called liberal theories and realist theories. And in a nutshell, liberal theories tend to look from the bottom up. They look within particular states and they say, well, these leaders or these organizations like bureaucracies are pathological or warped or distorted, and that causes distorted behavior or nasty behavior on the world stage. Realist theories tend to start at the top and look at how rational security maximizing actors or leaders look at the world, are uncertain about what might happen in the future, and therefore try their best in a sort of dutiful way to manage the security of their nations given the uncertainties about the future. Now, one of the biggest uncertainties, of course, is where is our power going? We're strong right now, let's say the United States for the last 20 years, but China is rising. So how do we deal with this change in the external environment, and how do we do that best so that we both maintain our security and avoid war? Well, within realism, this power-driven logic or realpolitik logic, there are at least two or three major camps. One of them is John Mearsheimer's offensive realism. And in a nutshell, it argues that because of that future uncertainty, all great powers are revisionist powers, even dominant ones. They're always struggling for more position, better management of the power environment so that it advantages them. So China and the U.S. are in a struggle for power, says John Mearsheimer, and that's inevitable and it's a given. The defensive realist comeback is to say, well, wait a minute, being too hard line in your policies, being too much in your face with the other is a recipe for creating mistrust, spirals of misunderstanding and hostility. And of course, that can lead to things like Cuban Missile Crises or worse, actual war. So both of these two big realisms, if you will, fight with one another and have for the last 25, 30 years. And I'm trying to insert myself into that debate and bring in both an integrative notion that both sides have insights that work together and a more dynamic notion that you can't just look at snapshots of relative power, who's bigger than whom and by how much. You also have to look at trends for the future and expectations, not just of relative military power, but of economic power and of the commerce that underpins that power. So, for example, you might want to look at Japan 1940-41 with the U.S. and say, oh, well, Japan's, in their minds and in the U.S. minds, they've got a 60-40 advantage in military power. That's a concern. Well, it's a concern, but it's much more of a concern if you look dynamically. And Japan believes by 1941 that it is peaking in relative power and declining relative to the rise of the U.S. And that makes the Japanese go into a different mode of thinking. Instead of saying, oh, we're still doing well, we're still rising, let's buy time for the future growth, the Japanese go into this mode of great anxiety. They try to bargain their way out of these economic sanctions that have been imposed on oil and raw materials. They get nowhere with that. And of course, what do? They hit Pearl Harbor and they start a total war for control of the Pacific. Now, in a nutshell, you can see that if you take a dynamic view, and by the way, John Mearsheimer really likes this view and is using it to think about the parallels between US Japan 41 and what could happen with China US today. So we want to look at that perhaps later. But in general, what makes this argument different is this orientation, not just to the uncertainties about the future, but the probabilities that things will get better or worse for us and for the other, and understand under what conditions we, by our own behavior, can actually adjust those concerns so that both sides can remain stable, remain peaceful with one another. And that's my obsession, which is to help China and the US understand these historical dynamics and moderate, not moderate their behavior, but to avoid mistakes like what happened in 41 with Japan and the US.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I guess Mearsheimer in his now almost 20-year-old or maybe more than 20-year-old book, Tragedy of Great Power Politics, essentially forecast a U.S.-China war based on this sort of notion of offensive realism. And of course, more recently, Graham Allison has suggested the same in his book Destined for War. And so since I agree that nothing is, you know, written in stone here, I think your notion of injecting the role of expectations of future trading environments into the international security environment judgments that policymakers are making is a very helpful helpful corrective. It also in your book is used as a kind of lens for examining not just the current moment, but as a kind of prolegomena to the current moment, a review of the entirety of American foreign policy history in a way that, and I don't want to be provocative, but reminded me very much of my own education as an undergraduate and graduate student with the sort of Wisconsin school, so-called, of diplomatic history, or the open door revisionists who argued that America's pursuit of the open door and of trade relations was the driving force in American foreign policy. Although you treat it with a slightly different valence, which is rather than making a kind of moral judgment on it, you argue it actually shows that American policymakers are actually, have been very effective historically at advancing the national interest and pursuing America's economic potential. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, this is what's so interesting, Eric, is that I actually borrow a lot from their quite phenomenal diplomatic historical documentary work, including Walter Lefebvre at Cornell, where you studied. And what I try to show is that they get a lot of the documents right in terms of interpreting that it was about commerce. It was about concerns of being cut off, America being cut off from access, let's say, to the Orient or access to Europe or access even to Latin America during Wilson's time during World War One. And yes, that was an important dimension of this that has been completely neglected by almost all realists and all liberals. So this is why that school has often been called neo-Marxist, which is a third pillar, if you will, that most people don't talk much about. But here's the big difference, Eric. What they argue, and this is right out of Marxism, it's a very liberal logic in my previous way of thinking about it. It's bottom-up. It's these firms that are driven by profit motives that are putting pressure on the leaders to open the door to China or open the door to Latin America. And it's these pressures that push, say, a Wilson into World War One or a FDR to push hard on Japan. Well, hey, that's one interpretation of the documents. But I think if you actually look carefully, you'll see that according to the documents that I've looked at, which are many of their documents, there's almost no evidence that it's the firms actually getting on the phone, so to speak, and phoning Wilson up and saying, we need war for these reasons. What is happening, rather, is this realist logic from the top down, where the national leader is saying, I'm concerned about U.S. national security. And because I am, I have to be concerned about U.S. GDP, because GDP and growing GDP is the foundation for long-term military power. And of course, for the U.S. naval power in particular, that Mahonian or Alfred Thayer Mahon strategy of both growing your Navy and growing your GDP simultaneously, which he saw as the British strategy for the 18th century. And how do you do that effectively? Well, of course, you have to be concerned about other great powers, let's say Germany and British, even in 1916, 1917, trying to weasel or muscle their way into your regions or into your areas, such as the Far East, and hurting your ability to keep your economy growing through trade. Now, why is that a different interpretation, even if I use some of their documents? It's because the motives, the logic, is realist. It's realist. It actually has these leaders as very dutiful, good individuals thinking about national security, not sort of craven, greed-based leaders who are beholden to these greed, profit-driven companies. So Walter Lefebvre, to his credit, had a lot of good documents in his famous book, but he gets McKinley completely wrong. McKinley didn't go into the Spanish-American War because of profit motives of a few firms in Cuba or elsewhere. He said, if I don't get access to Asia, we're sunk. Everyone else is scrambling. We have to get in there. And if we don't keep control of the Caribbean and keep control of the future Panama Canal, then we will lose our access to South America and the Pacific at the same time. So, you know, I interpret the same evidence, but I show that McKinley is far different from what the neo-Marxist revisionists put forward. So in a way, I'm going against three big groups of theories simultaneously with this, what I think to be a new argument.
So to bring it to the present day and the current U.S.-China situation, you break down sort of the prevailing schools of thought about China into China optimists and China pessimists, as you describe them. Can you explain how that fits into your own theory, Dale, and maybe talk about you outline four different potential scenarios as things go forward. Maybe you could outline those as well for our listeners and viewers.
Here's the thing. In fact, I get this language of optimist versus pessimist from one of my own graduate students, Brandon Yoder. And his basic approach, or at least categorization, is simple. those who believe that China is rising and will overtake the United States, and simultaneously have the Chinese have aggressive intentions to not necessarily take over Southeast Asia, that would be, say, Bridge Colby as a pessimist, but rather to extend their global power such that they become the dominant hegemon and then reshape the world political order in their image, not in the liberal democratic image. That is a pessimistic view, and you know, Aaron Friedberg and others put that forward, sometimes from a realist perspective, sometimes more from a ideological or liberal perspective. But the optimists have, they're not a single category, really. There's different types. But one thing that unites them is this view that China may or may not overtake the U.S. in total economic power. It may not become the dominant, quote, economic superpower. That's up in the air. It could, you know, peak early, or it could just simply peter out with its economic growth, as many people think it's doing even now. And second of all, maybe Xi Jinping is not as evil as he might seem, given some of his recent behavior. Evil in that quote-unquote sense of a crazy expansionist like a Hitler or even a Stalin who wants to take over and destroy the liberal economic world order and the political order. So how do I fit myself within that? Well, my point is actually simple, because we have a lot of different people who I say are kind of trying to look into the crystal ball and say, this is what's happening. China is rising. No, it's not. It's declining. China has a crazy leader, Xi Jinping, who's driven by glory and status. No, he's driven by security. What I simply say is, let's see what emerges as we gather more evidence. I'm all about, if in a terms of methodology, I'm all about not trying to be definitive in the snapshot view. You've gotten my theory, I know, Eric, and you know that I'm all about trends and expectations. And things could go very differently in the future, for example, if, for example, Xi Jinping believes China is like 1941 Japan and is peaking and declining and ready needs war now. Or it could be like Deng Xiaoping's view in the very optimistic 90s and 2000s, where China's growing by 10, 15% a year even. And let it keep growing. Let's hide our claws and bide our time and just keep growing. Let's not get into a war that might destroy the trade-based logic on which we built such economic growth. So here's the bottom line. Let's look at different scenarios. And ironically, this was actually something that I got out of working with Bridge Colby when he was Assistant Secretary of Defense back in 2018. He asked me to sort of do pro bono consulting work. And I put together a memo and I suddenly realized, well, there are at least three or four or five different scenarios we could talk about. But the main one is this. Ask the question, think of it as a 2x2, if you will. One question is China going to overtake the US or not? Or do we see trends that suggest China will be, let's say, 40% larger in GDP by 2035? Well, that's one question. The second question is China, let's assume it's largely rational. Xi Jinping and his associates are largely rational actors. They look and Machiavellianly calculate what they want to do to maximize their interests. But they are also largely driven by national security or domestic security. That is, keeping China peaceful at home and avoiding a Tiananmen Square repeat, the 1989 a crisis which almost overthrew the whole CCP regime, as you know, and was only shut down by the calling in of tanks and troops to Tiananmen Square to clear the square. Well, let's just think about it this way. If we assume, at least as a starting point, that Xi Jinping leans, if you will, or puts more emphasis on national and domestic security than he does on his own, let's say, glory or place in history. By the way, I think Putin has now gone the other way, or at the very least, he's very driven by his place in history and his reputation and his image. But Xi Jinping is a very calculating person, and I believe he pulls back when he sees that, you know, his glory drives are getting him into trouble on the security dimension. And security is more important to him, I believe, both national and domestic, And therefore, he's willing to make those kinds of rational trade-offs, sacrificing, let's say, grabbing Taiwan in the next year for glory, because he knows it would probably destroy 40 years of economic growth through the economic sanctions, not to mention the difficulties of attacking an island 100 miles off of China's coast. So here's how it would work. Let's imagine on this 2x2 that one dimension is this variable, oh, will China overtake the US or not? The other dimension is the simple question, will Xi and his cohorts remain largely security driven, or will they become more and more obsessively focused on glory and status and ideology? And like Mao, by the way, in the early 60s, spreading that ideology around the world at the cost to his own security. And Mao was clearly, I would call him an irrational, a non-security maximizer. He really did think that the glory of the revolution, the peasant-based revolution, was worth sacrificing national security for. And look, let's go back. Hitler is an obvious case of this. That's the extreme. But Genghis Khan in the Chinese history books is very much that way, going all the way to Hungary and Palestine for the glory of the Mongol Empire. This is the kind of thing that would, if we're in place in China, make China an extremely worrisome actor. Right now, we can talk about this. I don't think it's that way yet. But we can imagine trend lines or movements both domestically within China and internationally in terms of its global growth that would lead us towards another type of scenario than the one we're presently facing. And it's those trend lines, it's those anticipated expectations of the future that I would say should drive U.S. foreign policy. Not the snapshots, but what looks like it might be happening over the next 10 or 15 years. And then we can actually have a good debate, to be honest, about what have we learned in the last 2 years. So let's say we're up to now 2027 and you pull out my last chapter one more time and you say, well, you know, what's happened is that China hasn't overtaken the U.S. in economic power. It's not quite peaking, but we're growing at 3% a year and they're growing at 3% a year. So relatively speaking, we're both, you know, maintaining our positions and we're still on top. By the way, I think that's a very good scenario that we should try to create if we can. So I'm not just saying that would be nice. I'm saying we should try our best to make that happen through policy. Does that make some sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, let me ask you a couple of questions about all this. So one of the things you say at the outset of the book is that China mm-hmm. is a secure and stable superpower. And there's an assumption in the book, I would say, of bipolarity, that the major trend line here is U.S.-China relations, and that's really kind of the frame that you have the book in. I guess my question would be, we've seen this so-called no-limits partnership that Xi and Putin have announced. We've seen intensifying cooperation between the two, even as Russia has, you know, found itself in difficulty in the war in Ukraine. Avril Haines, the director of national intelligence, testified in front of the U.S. Congress 2 weeks ago that she couldn't rule out, in fact, thought it was perfectly plausible that in a Taiwan contingency, Russia either might join in and help China or open a second front somewhere to take advantage of this with opportunistic aggression. And the U.S. has, you know, got a whole raft of security commitments. Obviously, you focus in the book, or certainly in the last chapter of the book, on our commitments to our treaty allies in the Indo-Pacific. And that's certainly a comparative strategic advantage we have vis-a-vis China. But we also have commitments to our multilateral alliance in Europe. We have all these special relationships in the Middle East that are being tested even as we speak by the war in Gaza, you know, special relationship with Israel, special relationship with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, special relationship with Egypt, and as well relationships of that kind with Jordan and the UAE. How do you parse all of this out? I mean, is it really a bipolar situation, or is the U.S. facing what some people have called the the axis of upheaval.
Axis of upheaval. I like that. Well, I think, to be honest, the beauty of the logic that I put forward in the first couple of chapters is that you don't have to definitively decide on any of these issues exactly. What you can do is use the larger logic to inform a nuanced and multifaceted policy that takes into account what I would call the trade-offs and tensions in any international relations situation, but especially as you just described it right now. Is it bipolar? Is it unipolar? Is it multipolar? Should we be involved and spending money through the, you know, the recent Mike Johnson series of bills in the Middle East, Ukraine, and in Taiwan, East Asia? Or should we, as Bridge Colby and others have suggested, focus like a laser just on East Asia because China's getting ready to attack Taiwan, Southeast Asia, Philippines, and so forth? Well, here's how I would grapple with that. And it's always grappling. You want in international relations not to say, this is the truth. What you want to be able to do, if you're pragmatic, and I'm a big Aristotelian, if you go back to my roots in Canada and Toronto and University of Toronto philosophy, Aristotle, of course, talked about phronesis, and he talked about prudence, the way you grapple with the trade-offs that are in front of you. So you create what is often sometimes called the golden mean, but really what he said in the politics was a balance of the extremes. What did he mean? He meant that you try to create a policy, any kind of policy, domestic or international, where you take into account the truths, the insights of the extreme views, and then say, how do we grapple with the trade-offs between those extreme views? Here's how it goes. Think about, say, the Russian situation. Well, Russia clearly in GDP is the size of my country, home country, Canada, although I am getting new U.S. citizenship soon. But, you know, Canada's not a great power. And if Russia's GDP is the size of Canada, we can't say it's a tripolar world. What can we say? Well, it's bipolar and truly bipolar in the nuclear strategic realm, because China has 500 nuclear weapons, Russia has about 5,500, and we have about 5,500. And we're the two Mack trucks. That's why we're so worried about an escalation to nuclear war in Europe. And we're a Mack truck to a, let's say, a Winnebago or a Chevy van when it comes to East Asia. And the Chinese know it, and we know it. And they will swerve, or they'll basically try not to get on the road to chicken when it comes to East Asia, because they are strategically, at the nuclear strategic level, not yet a pole. Well, so what are we talking about? We're talking about a complex world, which is unlike the Cold War, by the way, where we're worried about a rising China, and we're worried about, you might say, a declining Russia, who is probably lashing out because its position in the world is really falling. Now, China has a very tricky game to play. And this is where I'm a follower of Henry Kissinger, not in his moral side of things, but in his strategic logic. What Kissinger has pointed out for a good 45 years is that China has always been torn. It has in its north a state that has 11 time zones and a 900-mile border to this day, a state called Russia. Now we call it Russia. It was the Soviet Union. That China almost went to war with in 1969. And we now know that Khrushchev in 1963 asked John F. Kennedy if the U.S. and the Soviet Union could coordinate a preventive strike against Mao's nuclear facilities. Yes, that's an unbelievable statement, because in the midst of a Cold War just after the Cuban Missile Crisis, both sides learning that they didn't want to have a Cuban Missile Crisis again, but now thinking, well, you know what? We're not crazy about China's involvement in North Vietnam. We're not crazy about Mao spreading peasant-based revolution. So we will help you to get rid of this threat, or at least its nuclear threat. Now, straightforwardly, why is that important? Because that has never gone away. China, as you know, has ongoing border disputes with India, another nuclear power, and you might call India a form of a pole, but I don't think so. But straightforwardly with Russia, China is always playing this very delicate game. Geography matters. It doesn't have a stable northern frontier to this day. And it has border disputes that are based around, guess what? The fact that Russia took advantage of China's weakness in the 1860s and took what we now call Vladivostok, but that whole eastern area that had belonged to China, not to mention parts of Mongolia. So that is not, it's nice to have for China, Russia diverted off to the west and fighting there so that they don't have to worry about the Siberian frontier and the worries about Russia of Chinese intrusion economically into Siberia. I'm not trying to paint this as, oh, Russia and China are going to go to war. I'm just trying to say geopolitically, there are lots of tensions and trade-offs in that relationship. Here's another one just to think about. Think about this. The Belt Road Initiative, of course, was China's way and a classic way in any great power strategy to keep your economic growth going by extending your, what I call your economic power sphere. Keep that growing. That growth that you're getting from the 1990s and 2000s, keep that growth going by having more and more connections to cheap raw materials and markets around the world. The US did it, the British did it, the Germans did it, now Chinese doing it, calling it the Belt Road, fine. But you know, this has been going on since 1997, Mignot's great book on this. Now, why is that important? Because part of the Belt Road, given all this infrastructure that China has been working on with all the 25 or 26,000 miles of high-speed railways, is to extend that through Central Asia to Europe. Now, why is Europe important? Because Europe, the EU, is China's largest trading partner and has been for a number of years. US is like number two, but EU is number one. That's partly why, you mentioned it, Xi Jinping has gone back to Europe to sort of say, hey, you know what? We're still open for business. Don't worry about our electric vehicles dominating your electric vehicle market. We want more investment. Keep your companies here. You know, he said the same thing, by the way, to Graham Allison one-on-one. And Graham Allison wrote a huge Twitter thread that said, oh, I met Xi Jinping and he's open for business and he wants us. Oh, forget about the destined for war stuff. I think we can work with this guy. It was an unbelievable post, by the way, for coming from a man who wrote a book called Destined for War. Now, why is this any of this important? Because here was the trend just before February 2022. China, in the 3 or 4 years before February 2022, went from trading, having shipments of its good on market value, shipments of its good go from 0% by rail to Europe to 4.5% in 4 years. And they thought it would go to 20% from the documents that I've seen and or more over the next year. And suddenly the Ukraine route is completely destroyed. And so is the other route because it goes through Belarus. And there's this other alternative route, a third one that goes through Turkey, but it's not very efficient. And they wanted the Ukraine route because that was the best, and that's gone. So is Xi paying a bit of an economic cost for this? Yes. Is he kind of torn between keeping Russia diverted and the US diverted in Europe and having the Belt Road Initiative, you know, not doing as well as he wanted it to? Yes, he's torn by that. And that means, bottom line, that when you look at this policy, one shouldn't just try to, as many people do, oh, China wants to invade Taiwan. Oh, China wants to work with Russia for a larger, full scope, full spectrum attack on liberal democracy. China needs economic liberalism around the world, whatever you want to call it. It needs free trade. It needs trade. Yes, it's mercantilist in its logic, but so were we. And so are we still to this day on chips. So we play this geopolitical game like they're playing it. And what we know more than anything, Eric, and this is the key, is that Russia is not dependent on the world economic system like China is. Russia exports its oil. So by invading Ukraine, it got the oil price to go up. And that's 40% of Russia's oil government budget right there. 50% is based on energy exports. China imports 80% of its oil or so, and mostly through the very vulnerable Malacca Straits. Yes, there's some more oil going to Russia, but bottom line there, China's GDP is 40% of it is dependent upon global trade, not trade with Malaysia, but global trade, the EU, the US, Japan, all these US allies. And is if you're smart, and I think Xi Jinping is extremely smart, this is where he's very different from Putin. He's not going to sacrifice China's internal stability, which is dependent upon GDP growth, for a crazy war over Southeast Asia that Bridge Colby talks about or alarmists talk about. He's not going to risk that by aligning and throwing his chips into the ring with Putin over what, Central Asia? What's that going to give him? He's really concerned about the Mahanian dimension of all of this. In my view, he's built up his navy and he wants that navy to have all these ports,
the flag, right?
Ports around the world. Yes, commerce follows the flag, but in this case, he's doing it. He's building a port, as you know, in West Africa, not just East Africa. Piraeus in Greece is now basically a Chinese port. He's got the projection of power going west across the Pacific, or I guess that's east across the Pacific, to South America, and kind of infiltrating through port calls, they call them. These nice little port calls where the ships come in and they say hi, and here's the Chinese flag, and we bring that up, and then the Ecuadorian flag goes up, or the Caribbean nation flag of your choice goes up. And guess what? I have a dissertation student, he's finished now, John Robinson, who did a brilliant analysis of this in his dissertation. He said, what are they doing with these hospital ships going into Jamaica and giving free healthcare to all Jamaican citizens that want it for a month? They're doing it because they want to make those nations say, we need China and you need China and everyone needs China. Let's keep this going. So this idea that somehow China's in this vast conspiracy with Russia makes no geopolitical sense. And if you want to assume that Xi Jinping is actually very crafty and stupid, then go for it. Go for this pessimistic view that he's going to attack the world or take over Southeast Asia through a massive campaign of 2,000 islands in the Philippines, by the way. He'd have to take over through a D-Day-like assaults. I'm ranting a little bit here, but you can see that I'm animated by this, what I feel to be this distorted view that often is there of people who don't look at the trade-offs. They don't look at the nuances of a multi-factor logic and just say, oh, it's all about this or it's all about that.
Well, but I don't know that you have to posit that he's geopolitically stupid. I mean, in the sense that it seems to me what he's done with support for Russia has been, very clever, right? I mean, not providing lethal assistance, but providing a lot of financing by buying Russian oil at knockdown prices, which certainly suits China's economic interests, while at the same time, providing China with precision, or providing Russia, excuse me, with precision manufacturing equipment that allows the Russian defense industrial base to power up and operate on a three-shift, 24-hour-a-day basis, which is now apparently Putin's theory for how he's going to win the war. That's why he's appointed Belousov to be the defense minister, someone who knows something about defense industry and how to keep it manageable without blowing up the Russian economy. So it seems to me that the Chinese, certainly for ideological reasons, don't want to see Russia defeated and are willing to run some risk, but not a lot of risk, with the West.
Yeah, let me talk to that, because here's again the trade-off logic that's embedded in my worldview. Think about it from Xi Jinping's point of view. One is that he believes, and it's quite evident that this is true, that the U.S. for a good 40, 50 years would like to see China liberalize, go democratic. All Chinese leaders believe that we had a hand in Tiananmen Square, for example. It's not just the Statue of Liberty that was erected in the middle of the Tiananmen Square crisis. It's the ongoing effort by Clinton and then Bush and then by Obama even to liberalize China through Voice of America broadcasts, through, let's say, bringing Chinese students over to see the wonders and beauty of the United States individualism. And half of them, or at least before the COVID crisis, about half of those Chinese students would stay in the US or Canada or Britain because they did like that liberal free side, free trade or free enterprise side of things. And human rights, let's be honest. So he's torn. Why is he torn? Because he believes strongly in the 5,000 years Chinese history model, what he calls the Confucian logic, not communism. Communism is, if you think of Mao, inspiring the people. Think of the 1966 calls to the people, and mainly young students, to rise up against the elite, Deng Xiaoping and so forth. Well, he doesn't want that. He knows that that's both dumb, Maoist dumb, but it's also very dangerous because it allows a form of, quote, liberal democracy to infiltrate itself back in. This was the 1980s and Hu Yaobang and some of the other so-called reformers who actually inspired the crisis that came out in 1989. He's smart. He did a whole study, by the way, in his first 3 months in office, a whole study of what happened in 1989-90 that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union and Tiananmen Square. And he created a 3-hour documentary for his own party members that they all had to watch. And what were the conclusions? This comes through a number of books that I've read. The conclusion was, never again will we let liberal democracy rear its ugly head and allow it to spread without shutting it down right away. Never again, by the way, will we allow economic problems, and there was very high inflation in the late 1980s, to inspire the workers, and not just these radical students, to rise up against us. And he's done a very good job in a way of, with surveillance technology, with all of the kinds of things that he's been able to do in terms of embedding the cadres, the party within, you know, let's just call them the free enterprise firms in China, like Alibaba and so forth, so that they know, this party knows exactly why and under what conditions the people might indeed rise up again. That's shutting it down. That's keeping domestic stability. So that's why at the start of the book, I said, hey, right now in the snapshot, China is a very stable society because Xi Jinping's done a great job of shutting down dissent, let's be honest. And he keeps that lid on very tightly. And I'm trying to get back to, I think, your point about Russia. But how do we deal with that? Well, one of the things we do is to align ourselves with the most obvious other authoritarian, top-down, centralized, Louis XIV kind of absolutist state. And that's, of course, Putin's Russia. And why is that important? It's not because Russia is sort of the spearhead for attacking Europe. Look, you're going to destroy the European economy by having Putin attack Europe. That would make no sense to a country that where the U, this is China, which gets 10 times as much trade from trading with the US and the EU than it gets with Russia itself. You're going to kill that golden goose? No. Why do you want Russia in the thing? Not only to divert it away from your own border that you've had conflict with, not only to get them out of Mongolia and all these other interventionist things, not just to get them out of Central Asia, which you would like to, Xi Jinping, to dominate economically and build your high-speed railways through. That's all good geopolitics. Why do you want Russia? Because it does represent this larger, and in my colleague's sense, John Owen's sense, it does represent this larger ideological, not goal, not to spread. This is not Cold War 2.0 where you're spreading ideology, to consolidate around the world those who represent authoritarian top-down structures, keep those actors in power so that the darn liberal democracies don't spread their radical views. That's why Russia's important. Now, you mentioned China helping Russia's economy. Well, let's look at this. They have not violated the rules that we set down for how sanctions work with Russia. They have not given, as far as I know, Russia military equipment. They have indeed given them precision equipment that will help them manufacture, but that wasn't made illegal by the sanctioning regime. And indeed, what does that do? Well, it helps them make munitions. Well, let's be honest, their munitions were so depleted that they had to rely on North Korea for munitions and Iran for drones. This is not a strong Russian economy, at least in my view. And China's propping it up, whatever. That's not geopolitically, I think, a major concern. A major concern would be all out, you know, kind of fascist collaboration, a la 1941 to 45, to build up, you know, the main kingpin, which was China. This is not that. So there's an ideological dimension, but it's very different from the Cold War. And this is where I go really against Hal Brands. This is not Stalin in 1951 or something like that. This is something very different. Anyways, I'll turn it back to you.
Let me ask you something that I, you know, kind of, I found myself wrestling with as I read the book, which is, you make this distinction between, you know, rational power maximization on the one hand, and then, as you put it, you know, glory, status, and ideology on the other. It's not clear to me that that Xi Jinping and his colleagues in Beijing see things in that stark a term, that they see these as alternatives. On the contrary, there seems to me to be a lot of evidence that they don't see the line between these things as impermeable as you suggest in the book. I mean, this is a country that spends more on internal security than it does on external security, and it's spending a lot on external security. I mean, Mackenzie Eaglin at AEI just did a study of Chinese defense spending, which, you know, when you add in all the stuff that they don't actually put into their defense budget, you know, her numbers come out to something like $710 billion, which is pretty damn close to our budget, but without a lot of the global responsibilities that we have in other parts of the world. So, you know, how do you parse out the sort of worry about ideological pollution and, you know, and power maximization? I mean, obviously, they're very worried about their situation, you know, at home, which is a point you make throughout the book, but that seems to be in tension with the notion of rational power maximization externally.
Yeah, though these are great questions, Eric. And indeed, you're getting at the heart of the true tensions that I kind of glide over a little bit, partly because I want to write another book on this, but also because you can only cover so much in one book. And I do cover a heck of a lot. But here's how it would work. Here's how it would work. You think about the old, do you remember your microeconomics 101, where you have your indifference curves that are kind of shaped like this, and you making trade-offs in the classic one between beer and chips? Well, always there's a kind of a curve that looks like this in those diagrams, which implies that you personally are making trade-offs when you give up some of your money to buy more chips and don't put it onto beer. That's the simple example. Sometimes it's quiche, not beer. I mean,
the classic one is the Phillips curve between inflation and full employment.
Right, that's a different curve. This one, that's about macro variables. This is micro. It's about the internal psychology of a particular decision maker, right? And if you remember that micro example, it's about a single person. Let's call him Eric Edelman. And he's going to the store and he's trying to decide, should I put my money towards beer or chips? Well, I really like beer, so I'm going to get, no, this is not Eric. Let's call him John. John wants, you know, to buy three cases of beer and get a couple of bags of chips. Fred over here, or Sally, wants chips more and gets the 10 bags of chips and a couple of bottles of beer. Why is that important? Because they are, relatively speaking, making trade-offs towards their objectives. Now, here's how it works in practice. I'm not saying, and you'll, if you read that carefully for the last chapter, but also chapter two, I'm not saying that a Xi Jinping doesn't like glory. Of course he does. He stands up on the military platforms and he goes in his cocky outfits and he talks about the China dream and the uniting of the reunification of Taiwan within that China dream and all these great dates in history, 2035 and 2049 and the 100th anniversary of the People's Republic, all very much, you might say, status in orientation. What matters to any decision maker, if they're rational, is how do you make trade-offs when push comes to shove? If, for example, let's take a concrete example. Bridge Colby and others, alarmists, think that in the next 2 years, even before the DOD thinks China would be ready for an invasion of Taiwan, even before that, right? In the next year, they might go to attack Taiwan because they see the opportunity and they go for it. Well, hey, I looked it up a little bit. Let's do some research. It takes at least 1.2 million people to land on the shores of Taiwan to have a 50-50 chance of winning the island. The Taiwanese have, by the way, 1.8 million in reserves or in active duty. Now, that's a ratio against you. It's defensive dominant, so it's very hard to attack Taiwan. And Bridge Colby said, it's very difficult, quote unquote, to make these amphibious assaults. Now, that's one island, by the way.
Toughest thing to do in military affairs. No one's really done totally it since 1950.
And look, I looked this up as well. How many landing, you remember D-Day, and it took 2 years of total 45% of GDP devoted to defense to get ready for a D-Day and some of the other attacks. We put off Stalin for 2 years. He was furious because we didn't have the landing craft, largely, for a D-Day. Now, you ask yourself, if you're ready, according to the alarmists, to go for a D-Day-like invasion of an island that's not 20 miles off your shore like the English Channel, 100 miles off your shore, and it's rocky and it's low in there's a low level of a sea, so makes landing hard, and it's rocky, so it's not beaches like Omaha, and you haven't built the landing craft, to do this, then what is your buildup really all about? Well, here's how I would turn it back and say, let's infer that the massive economic and let's say military buildup of mostly the Navy, but some of it is strategic, is largely driven by this recognition for 25 years, not just Xi Jinping, that we need a global blue water Navy. That's what we really need. We need the technological qualitative advantage so that we aren't the Winnebago or Chevy van and chicken games. And we can project power to the Atlantic. We can project power into the Mediterranean and hold our own if anyone tries to leverage us. Now, this to me is a better inference about why there's a massive Chinese buildup. It is about a defensive notion. Not that they wouldn't use it offensively, but it's about a defensive notion, a la Mahan, of protecting what is most valuable to your long-term national security, GDP growth, and domestic security, the legitimacy of your own regime and needing to get at least 3% growth a year to be legitimate. Now, is this a different vision of what's going on with US-China? Yes. Is it a different sense of trade-offs? Trade-offs. Yes. Wouldn't it be nice to take Taiwan next tomorrow at no cost? Let's grab it. But when you make the trade-offs and your beer versus chips analogy comes back in, you'd have to say, well, he's not going to trade off 40 years of economic growth and kill the golden goose just to do what a Putin is doing, which is destroying his own long-term GDP by a Ukraine war. He's not going to do that over Taiwan. Now, might he have that capability to do the silly thing and go after Taiwan at big cost and risk if Taiwan is stupid enough to declare independence? Darn right he might. That's the worry, isn't it? That Taiwan does what it tried to do, or at least hints at, in 1995 and talk about the independence, and that it was, of course, the crisis that you know and love, where Bill Clinton brought the Seventh Fleet in, said, we're the Mack trucks, swerve, and the Chinese swerved. Well, that actually caused the Chinese to realize they needed to have a true Navy. They really did. Well, great. 25 years later, they have a pretty darn good Navy. What are they using it for? Not just to go and attack Taiwan. What they're using it for is this larger global, very smart global strategy. And that includes, by the way, projecting power against the Malacca Straits, which we can get into in a second if you want. And this is not the same kind of logic that says Xi Jinping is a Hitler. Xi Jinping is a Stalin and is going to do a Korean War-like thing in 1950. This is a Xi Jinping who says, my gosh, when I make these trade-offs and I think about my long-term legacy as a Chinese leader, I don't want to be the leader that said, that history books say, I attacked Taiwan. I lost 150,000 men in the first 5 or 6 days. And we didn't win it after 5 years of warfare. And I destroyed the Chinese economy and led to revolution. He doesn't want that to be his legacy. You can believe that when he goes around talking to the Graham Allisons and the Macrons of the world and saying, China's open for business. We're not bad. We've pulled back from wolf warrior diplomacy. We want, you know, we want good relations. We don't want to destroy the liberal economic system. If you call it liberal, that's fine. Just call it free trading system and we'll be on board for that. And here's the final kicker. Guess what? This makes perfect sense from his internal point of view more than anything, because that's his ultimate fear. His ultimate fear is Tiananmen Square. Just look at what he did in the first 6 months of power, where he put all of his emphasis on increasing surveillance, increasing the CCP's understanding that they couldn't be as corrupt, the leadership couldn't be as corrupt and keep legitimacy. So he started to purge the most corrupt people. Yeah, helped his power, but he also gave legitimacy back to the elites so that they could be seen in the Confucian sense as though those that were dedicated to the long-term benefit of the whole. That's the Confucian model, and he underpinned that quite nicely. This is why Louis XIV comes in mind, because Louis XIV had the exact same problems and made the same trade-offs, except he started a war in 1688. No, we can get into that if you want.
Dale, we're running out of time, unfortunately. I mean, obviously, this conversation could go on for a long time. I just for the record, I want to say that I have always believed that PRC was more likely to launch a kind of distant blockade of Taiwan rather than a land invasion. And I do worry, though, about how aggressive they are. You made the point that the U.S. and Russia have far larger at this point nuclear arsenals than China does, but the projections are that China will have a fully peer force of 1,500 some odd warheads by the middle of the 2030s. And since most of our projections about their military modernization have actually undershot rather than overshot, it might happen earlier than that. But I want to kind of have one final question for you to wrap up, which is, you have a very, a lot of your argument is, let's not borrow trouble. Let's not make assumptions about what the end state is with the PRC. A lot of things can happen. A lot depends on these projections of future security environment, including the commercial trade dimension of it. I take that all. But you also have a very long list of Chinese, I would call, bad behavior of the crisis over the Senkaku Islands with Japan in 2010, and then the militarization of the South China Sea, the island features in the South China Sea, even after Xi Jinping promised President Obama at a summit that the PRC would never do that, the Belt and Road Initiative, the wolf warrior diplomacy, all the things we've talked about, the threats against Taiwan, some that we haven't talked about, including the military exercises and penetrations of the air defense information zone around the time both before and after the trip of Speaker, then House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan. So, all of this stuff. So if you were a policymaker in Washington, sort of having that as a background, at what point do you draw the conclusion that this is an aggressive rival that we really have to contain? Because I don't think you really give an answer to that in your book. I mean, when do you know, and how do you know? What are the indicators and warning?
Yeah, I deliberately don't, because in a way, this is part of that Rorschach test of understanding the other's ink blots, if you will, and understanding their personality type, and then making judgments and then making trade-offs. And I want the book, you might say, to last by not just looking in the crystal ball and saying, oh, this is what's going to happen, and then I'm wrong in 2 years and people throw the book out. I want them to be able to say, hey, I've got a set of tools here. I can understand different dynamics and different trade-offs in different ways so that as these trends emerge or move in a different direction from what we thought the trend was going to be, you can go back and look at the book and go, oh, I see. Yeah, it's this scenario now that's emerging. Let's go with that. And I am more than willing to say that, and I say this explicitly, that Xi Jinping does do a lot of bad behavior. That's exactly right. Here's the question. How do we interpret that bad behavior? Let's go back in our own history and ask the question, how do we interpret McKinley starting a war with Spain, another liberal democracy, in 1898? How do we interpret the U.S.-Mexican War, where Polk tries very straightforwardly to buy California for a good chunk of change, 40% of Mexico, basically. And when it's outrageously refused by the Mexicans that they would sell 40% of their territory, he then just starts a war with that country. How do we interpret that? How do we interpret going back to the War of 1812 and Madison and Jefferson's decision to get a war going with the British while the British are fighting the big bad Napoleon? Well, and of course, as a Canadian, I have to say, attacking Canada out of the blue. I just have to bring that in. Is this America, the sweet nation of America? No. Is it wolf warrior diplomacy? And I call it eagle diplomacy. Is it eagle diplomacy rather than wolf warrior diplomacy? Yeah. But this is, by the way, what great powers do. This is what great powers have to do, according to my early chapters, to sustain their growth and to develop themselves. Not in your face all the time, but taking opportunities to push and then pull back and push and pull back, depending upon the situation, so that they can build their larger economic power spheres and their larger. And the U.S. did not get to 50 states plus the colony of Philippines, plus the territories of Guam and blah, 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 by niceness. Puerto Rico, niceness, no. But why is that important? Because the Chinese, as a rising power, and I'm just going to state this bluntly because it's so obvious, have not done nearly as many militaristic things as the U.S. did. Now, I'm trying to become an American citizen. I love this country. I think it's a great country. But the history, if you're a Native American or if you're a Filipino, is not that this great country of the U.S. is sweet and nice as it's growing. Now, is China sweet and nice? No. Is it willing? This is the key. Is it willing to learn that its wolf warrior diplomacy and its in-your-face diplomacy has a cost? Yes. And that makes it rational. What has happened since November? Xi is saying, basically, that wolf warrior diplomacy, that was some, underlings that got out of hand. I'm not that way. He's saying to Graham Allison, face-to-face, like literally 2 feet away, I'm invited you over here because you said destined for war. I don't believe it. It's not true. Here's why we want good relations. And Graham, to his credit, you might say, says, oh my God, I've had my Gorbachev moment. Not Gorbachev, that's a bad analogy, but you remember Margaret Thatcher saying, I can do business with this person.
Maybe
that's
not
how
so
I
bad.
Interpreted Graham Allison's. Well, hey, Gorbachev was extremely smart and he was a Leninist. In his memoirs, he says, I'm a Leninist. Well, hey, you know what? Xi Jinping is not
no
a Leninist. He is.
I'm afraid we've run out of time,
sense.
Dale.
He's certainly not a Maoist. Okay, sure. But bottom line, I'll just say the last thing. Bottom line is look towards how he moves back and forth and adjusts to trade-offs. And then you can make judgments as just whether we can create like a 1972 detente, Kissinger style, through trade linkages and so forth, to make someone we don't like work within the present system.
Our guest has been Dale Copeland, a professor in the government department at the University of Virginia. And he is the author of A World Safe for Commerce, American Foreign Policy from the Revolution to the Rise of China. Dale, thank you for joining us on Shield of the Republic.
Thank you so much, Eric.